Welcome to Wisdom Rebellion, where we are figuring out how to improve our health, relationships, and family life with the help of the world's leading experts in how we get there, one challenging conversation at a time. Today, I'm speaking to Dr. Paul Morland. He's an author and broadcaster who writes and speaks about population and the big demographic trends across the world. Described as the UK's leading demographer and one of the world's preeminent demographers, Paul has written three books, Tomorrow's People, The Human Tide, and Demographic Engineering, and his work has been translated into 9 languages. He has written for and been interviewed in many of the world's leading newspapers and magazines, including the Financial Times, the Sunday Times, the Telegraph, the Toronto Globe and Mail, Der Spiegel, and Jerusalem Post. He has broadcast on many outlets, including BBC Radio 4. Paul has been an Associate Research Fellow at Birkbeck University of London and a senior member at St. Anthony's College, Oxford. He lives in London, is married, has 3 children, and is a dual British and German citizen. We discussed how demography shapes our lives and cultures, why the West is relying so heavily on mass immigration, the backlash to the policy decisions that got us here, and what other solutions might be available to countries in Europe. We are talking about subjects that are sensitive to discuss in the mainstream media, but despite being challenging, these issues are important. Enjoy the conversation. Should we tax the childless?
I think we would not be wise to propose a policy called taxing the childless, and I've never proposed that, although I did write an article once where that was the headline. And what I suggested in that article was a number of things. One is that we have a real issue of childlessness and too few children. Secondly, that we should acknowledge that, and we've never had a government that has acknowledged it. And thirdly, we then need to look at a variety of policies to address it. Now, what would those policies be? There are a whole range of things in my new book, which is coming out later this year, No One Left, will address very systematically what other countries have tried, what appears to work and what doesn't. And by the way, I think policy will anyway only get us so far. But if we are looking at policies, we have to look at the tax and benefit systems. Now, at the moment in the UK and in many other countries, we have a benefit system that gives you money if you have children. Is it high enough? Too low? Does it crawl money back in the right way? Should it go to an endless number of children? All up for debate, but it's absolutely accepted that if you have children, you get extra benefits called child benefit. Now it used to be called family allowance, and that's very normal. Now, I don't have a problem with at least discussing whether we should reflect having children in the tax system, as many people do. Now, of course, the easy answer then is tax cuts for the childless, but we know that the government's running a very big deficit. So rather than just say, I'm a demographer and I think you should throw money at this issue, my issue, as if no other people from defence to health to every other cause aren't calling on the government for money. Rather than that, I'm saying maybe we should have something that is tax neutral, possibly, but which recognises childbearing and changes the tax burden so that you pay a little less if you have children and a little more if you don't. So that is the slightly long-winded answer to a question, a very blunt question. It needs a slightly more nuanced answer, forgive me.
I definitely wanted to chat about it because I've seen the numerous headlines that were quoting that article, and a lot of them were outraged, obviously, like in terms of like, how dare you potentially penalize women for X, Y, and Z. That was always the lens through which those headlines were written. But not many actually struggled with the problem that people that haven't got children that are then paying into the system and paying taxes to support our system are essentially relying on other children's or other people's children to support them in their late life. And is it can't remember the statistic, you might know, but it's something the elderly takes about 75% of the government's sort of spending, if you like. So the costs are massive for looking.
Well, it very much depends how you cut government spending. And I think one thing, for example, we know is that older people require much, much more spend in the health service, perhaps five or six times as much when they're in their 80s as when they're in their 20s or 30s. Whether you look at it through the lens of government spend, or you look at it through the lens of the availability of labour, when people are elderly, they need more healthcare, they need very often social care, they're very likely to retire, and you can change the retirement date, but it doesn't make that much difference. And people react to it very strongly. So I think you've exactly correctly put your finger on the problem, which is that if we don't have enough children, we will end up, and we increasingly are ending up as a society, and more countries are in the same situation, many are worse than us, where we have more and more people of retirement age and fewer people of working age. Now, I'll just give you a couple of statistics on that. When I entered the workplace in the 1980s, and a lot of us late baby boomers were coming into the workforce, if you looked at the over 65s to the 20 to 65, so the retirees, and yes, you can change the date a little bit, as a share of the working population, it was a quarter. Now it's a third. By the end or by the middle of the century, so just in sort of 25 years, 30 years or so, it will be a half. So in other words, would have gone in my lifetime, if I'm still alive in the 2050s, from my 20s to, say, my 80s or 90s, would have gone through from having four workers for every retiree to having two workers for every retiree. And when the retirees are so intense in consuming government expenditure and the working population is having to pay the tax, then the whole system is not going to work. Now, one thing I did want to say, though, in response to your particular point about the outrage on my article, I have no problem with outrage. I think everything I said is reasonable and I'll stand by it, but I do not object to people objecting to me and having a good debate. I think one of the reasons to write the article and to write the books that I've written is to make sure that people are starting to discuss these things, because it's a bit late. But the point I made when I wrote the article, and there was a lot of publicity around, I went on the radio, the television, and what. The point I was making was this. Nobody says, how unfair, I don't have a child, I don't get child benefit. Now, there are 1,001 reasons you might not have a child at home. For example, I don't get child benefit because my children are all grown up, right? Other people don't get child benefit because they chose not to have children. Other people didn't get child benefit because they couldn't have children. But nobody says, this is outrageous, and I couldn't have children, but I should still get child benefit. It's not my fault. So nobody has a problem with that around the benefit system. I don't see why people should have a problem with it around the tax system. If you actually are prepared to see people not get child benefit because they can't have children, then similarly, you should be prepared to see the tax system adjust in a similar way. Now, you may agree or disagree, but I don't think you've got any right to be outraged, because I don't see anybody being outraged by the child benefit system.
No, I think as a culture, we are slightly oversensitive to any potential infringement of what we consider our freedom. And it tends to kill the debate about the problems that are actually quite pressing and quite difficult. And like I said, I haven't seen in many of those headlines the actual wrestling with the problem at hand, that the aging population with the limited amount of working aged adults to support that generation and how that society is going to look. So I just wanted to open up with it, because I did think that the Times chose the headline wisely.
Well, wisely, if you want to get publicity. I have a friend who I told I was writing this article, and as soon as he saw it, he said, that's clickbait. Yeah. I didn't know what the meaning of the word clickbait was, but now I do. But, you know, when you write an article, you don't choose the headline, and I've got no objection. I did a podcast with someone the other day, and he was very good. I thought he asked me very good questions. We had a very good discussion And then he entitled the thing something like Wokeness is a Death Cult. Well, I didn't say that. I don't really. I mean, I'm very anti-woke, but I wouldn't quite call it that. But yeah. And I think there is some sort of link between low fertility and wokeness and issues around fertility and arguing about demography and whether you can do that in a way. But all that's fine. That doesn't mean I said wokeness is a death cult. I think when you stick your head above the parapet, you've got to be prepared to stand by what you say and what you write in the understanding that people are going to put strap lines and headlines on it to get attention, which is just the way the world and algorithms work today. I completely understand that. So I'm not going to object to it.
So before we dive into the demographics and what that can teach us about the society today and in the future, can you walk us through the demographic transitions and what they are and how they
yes.
work?
So this is really important in understanding the economic background and the development background to the last 200 years of history. And it was very much the focus of my second book, The Human Tide. Thomas Malthus, back at the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th, identified a system, a demographic system, essentially, which said we have lots and lots of children because we can't do any other as long as we're sort of married or engaged in sexual relations, which most people are going to be for most of their fertile years in any society. And that will result in 6, 7, 8 live births per woman. But if every couple doubled, tripled or quadrupled itself, over a fairly short period of time, you'd have billions and billions of people. So starting with a quarter of a billion, say, in the year one, you'd have had hundreds of billions by the year 500. Well, the planet can't afford that. The planet couldn't have kept in the year 500 anything like 8 billion, never mind hundreds of billion. So what happens? You have a very high death rate. Lots of people die young. And if war or famine don't get you, then there just won't be enough food and people will die. And he was making that argument against Enlightenment thinkers and saying that it was impossible to have a fair, just world with the end of poverty. So that was, if you like, the opening conditions. But as he was writing that, things began to change. Once you get more food, industrialization, mass imports of food into Europe from newly settled lands in the Americas and Australia, which had previously supported very small populations of primitive agriculturalists or hunter-gatherers. So you have this enormous increase in food production, railways, boats, and industrial exports, and the tapping of fossil fuels, suddenly the constraint comes off. And what happened in the course of the 19th century in Britain and then the rest of Europe and then around the world is that the fertility rate initially stayed high. People still kept on having lots of kids, but they didn't all die off. And so you get a population growth. So if phase one is that low, that the Malthusian world with a low population, high birth, high death, you then have a rising population with lots of births, but fewer deaths and longer life expectancy. Then the next phase, the third phase, is when people actually find the means and the desire. They're so wealthy and urbanized and educated, they actually don't want to have huge numbers of children. And that then leads to the fertility rate to fall. And finally, the fertility rate and the mortality rate more or less converge is the model. This model wasn't really developed academically until the early 20th century, but it began to apply in the British Isles at the beginning of the 19th century. Then you get to a high population, low fertility, low mortality rate. And the idea was that you'd carry on forever with a couple of kids per couple, or slightly more than two, and that most of those, vast majority, would make it through their own fertile years and have two children themselves. And so I'd say the end of the middle of the 20th century, Britain, Germany, were all through that. They had a post-war baby boom, which has been surprising. But basically, families were 2, 3, maybe 4. The population stabilized, and parts of the world that then got that kind of industrialization prosperity, they started to go through, which is why we then saw very rapid population growth in places like the Middle East, in India, now in Africa. And we're all almost through this, except parts of Africa and very small parts of countries like Yemen, Pakistan, fertility rate is falling. But once we're through that demographic transition, so we've all come out the other side, we're all able to access contraception. life expectancy is somewhere between 70 and 80. Infant mortality is extremely low, so low as to be statistically insignificant. We're all through that material transition. The question then is, who's having three children and who's having two-thirds of a child? So if you take Korea and Israel, both prosperous countries, urbanized countries, countries where overwhelmingly the majority of women can access contraception. In Korea, they have two-thirds, and now, well, two-thirds to three-quarters of a child per couple. That means that each cohort is a third of the size of the last one. You go from two people to two-thirds of a person, which means you lose nearly 90% of your cohort after two generations. In Israel, they're having three children per woman, and there are lots of complex reasons, coronations, religion, ideology, etc., which we can explore. But that, in some ways, once you, I mean, the two big questions in demography, really, are number one, how quickly will Africa come through the fertility transition? And that's a very variable picture, say, Kenya and Ethiopia, very different from Nigeria and Chad. So that's one question. It's always like, how fast will history catch up in those parts of the world? Which will, in any case, mean we have a very large African population, and it will grow very quickly, but how fast tech will grow, how far it will grow, how long it will keep growing depends on what the pattern of African fertility. That's one big question. The other big question is, where is fertility going to head in the developed world? Between Israel, which is three, is not that high, but still for a developed country, it's incredibly high, and two-thirds of a child, Korea, where do we think we're going in the UK, for example? Where's Poland going? Where's the States going? And in all these cases, fertility has been below two for the best part of 50 years and is generally sinking. In fact, a lot of data has come in recently, Japan, the UK, Korea, it's all pointing downward. I mean, I think the values of Generation Z are not necessarily antenatal, but they correlate with a lot of antenatal sentiments. And I think they'll have small families as a cohort. So the fertility rate will fall. So that really what... rather lengthy answer, that is the demographic transition. And then when we come out of it, people have talked about a second demographic transition where we all get postmodern and have small families and require mass immigration. So actually, I think there are different fates. It's more about culture and values and less about how economically developed, how urban, how wealthy, and how educated you are.
But realistically speaking, do we have... like prognosis or a selection of choices of the most likely next demographic transition? Because yes, the Western countries haven't actually gone through it yet, but I'm assuming that depending on the paths that we take, we might have like a bit of the future, you know, sketched out for us in terms of what that will look like. So do demographers look at projections of what could be the next transition?
Well, demographers do look at projections, but the projections tend to be fairly consensus-based. So, for example, the UN has got very consistent forecasts and people, and they're good because people then argue around. For example, there was a book out a couple of years ago by Edward Pace saying actually he thinks that previously there'd been a critique of the UN saying that they aren't focusing enough on the fall in African fertility. And he was arguing actually African fertility is not falling all that far. So those are the projections around which we can have those kinds of debates. But I don't think demographers per se are particularly qualified with their noses in the detail to answer questions like, for example, what are the values of Generation Z? How will they correlate to fertility? So, for example, I wrote a paper with a friend of mine called Philip Pilkington a few months ago, and we both think, based on our gut instinct to some extent, to a little extent on the actual data from early 20s fertility, but also my observation of young people in the West, that in most Western societies, the UN may have seen, you know, forecast slight tailing off of fertility, or actually in some cases it rising back up towards replacement level. We're very pessimistic. If you think low fertility is a bad thing, we're very pessimistic on the correlation of the value of the coming generation and the who are each year more and more share of the people of fertile years, and the correlation of those values with fertility. So in Britain, for example, we're very shocked that the fertility rate is now below 1.5, just below 1.5. Having been up at quite close to 1.92 not all that long ago, 10, 15 years ago. Now, if you go to most mainstream demographers or the UN and they do projections, they're not really going to say we're going to trail it off towards Korean levels over 20 years. But I think it could well reach Korean levels in the UK and elsewhere. I think we could well, having thought, oh, Singapore, one child per woman, that's one child per two people, a halving of each cohort. We thought that was as low as it could get. We've now seen in Korea it can go to two-thirds of a child per couple. And I don't see that the Western European countries, Eastern European countries are already lower. I don't think necessarily we are going to avoid the fate of Korea. I can't tell you how low it will get or how long it will stay there. But I think there's a lot in contemporary culture that is going to lead us towards a significantly lower fertility rate than we've got. And I think we're already suffering from 50 years of sub-replacement fertility. So 50 years when it was in the 0.7, 0.8 range. We are building up huge problems by being now down below 1.5, and I think it'll drift down for every year as Generation Z become a larger share of the cohort of childbearing people. The fertility rate will continue to go down.
So you hinted about the research paper that you wrote. This is the demographic trilemma. So can you tell us what that trilemma is and what choices do nations have?
I wrote in my last book, Tomorrow's People, about the trilemma. And then I did a TED talk that explained it. At the end of the TED talk, I wrapped it up. And essentially the idea is that we have a choice between three things. And for shorthand, I call them the three E's. So ethnic homogeneity, economic growth, and egotism. Call egotism a shorthand for small families. If you want small families and economic growth, you've got to have mass immigration or your dependency ratio would get out of whack. That's what I call the UK solution. If you want ethnic homogeneity and small families, you end up like Japan with an economy that becomes less and less of the share of the world's economy. I mean, I remember when Japan was the land of the rising sun and had a growing economy. It had 30 years of very low growth and rising government debt. And the fact that Japan's got the high 250% of GDP is government debt is quite shocking, actually well higher than anywhere else and related to its demography. And then the only other solution is Israel, where you've got high fertility and economic buoyancy without the need for mass immigration. A country of immigrants, Israel now has below OECD average immigration. It doesn't need immigration to keep its economy going. So what I did with Philip Pilkington was to model this. So actually say, all right, if we take the UK as it is at the moment, and we say we want to keep the dependency ratio, the balance of retired and non-retired, but we don't fix the fertility rate. In fact, it continues to drift down. How much immigration will we need? And the answer was, by sometime in the 2080s, half the population will be first-generation immigrant. In other words, we'll have to be shipping people in on a massive level. Now, I know you're from Poland. I have a view, if you look at the Polish fertility rate, on the one hand, and the rapidly narrowing wage levels between us and Poland, if British people think we can still ship in Poles in the way we've done the last 20 or 30 years to do so much of the work in the economy, we're kidding ourselves. So more and more countries we'll be going low fertility, we'll lose our economic edge, and we'll find it harder and harder to recruit immigrants. We'll have to recruit them from the few remaining countries with high fertility rates where they'll be quite unproductive because they would have been well educated. So I don't think that's the direction we want to go into. And the second way, the Japanese way, is to say, okay, we'll just stop immigration, which some people argue for, but we won't fix our fertility rate. Just how bad will our dependency ratio go? And unsurprisingly, we'll get to the Japanese levels before very long. And, you know, good luck. Let's hope our government, in those circumstances, is able to borrow up to 250% of the per capita GDP. We've struggled at around 100% as Liz Truss saw. So I'm not sure that that's even a financially workable, viable solution. And the only solution, therefore, is to raise your fertility rate. And obviously, whilst I'm trying to be impartial and say there are these three choices, I'm clearly indicating my own preferred choice. I think the others are disastrous. And that is to say to people who don't like immigration, or people who think we could turn it off overnight, maybe we should focus on immigration for economic purposes and workforce. There's a lot of other immigration. But ultimately, unless the people of these islands from all backgrounds, all races, all religions, unless we in this very multi-ethnic country of ours are able to reproduce ourselves, we're either going to have endless mass immigration or we're going to have real labor problems.
Paul, can you just explain something to me? Because there seems to be a little bit of the paradox in the approach of the UK to, you know, filling this hole. And I can't quite understand exactly how it works. UK has essentially decided to import people instead of create their own, if you like. So we are fixing the problems and the shortfalls, I suppose, of the young population by immigration. And this is supposed to be done to strengthen the economics. However, at the same time, we know, for example, that low-skilled immigration, which is what we currently have in the UK, is not a net benefit to the economy. It's a loss to the economy. So just square it up for me.
I think I'm actually speaking to you from an office of a policy think tank. And if you speak to the people at think tanks, they will tell you that government ministers are constantly under pressure from industry and business. And what the industry and business leaders say is we need more labor. We can't get the labor, whether it's because too many people are getting old or too many people are getting sick, which, by the way, is an issue. But our participation rates, if you look at the participation in the labor force of people of working age, is quite high historically. I'm not saying it couldn't be higher. We used to have lots of women who didn't work. We used to have mass unemployment. So by historical standards, our participation rate's still quite high. And yet people still can't get the labor. And that puts huge pressure on government. Government wants people to, first of all, they want to keep the city happy. They want to keep business happy, not just so that people sign them, but so that the houses get built, care homes get manned, and so on. And all of that leads to tax revenue. If you get a baby today, that baby won't be part of the labor force paying tax for 20 to 25 years. But if you ship in an immigrant, he or her can go straight into the workforce. And even if that doesn't improve per capita GDP, which is what the government should be worrying about, the government has a mass of debt, and that debt needs to be serviced not by per capita GDP, but by GDP. So in effect, it's recruiting more people into the system to support the government finances, even if overall we're a little bit worse off as a result. So all this argument about whether immigration contributes to the economy per capita or overall, I think a lot depends on who the immigrants are, of course. But I think as long as we have too few people, British-born people, coming through into the workforce, there will always be pressures on the government from the business leaders to have more and to man all these jobs. And I remember having this discussion with a former Thatcherite government minister, who's obviously quite elderly now, but he in his prime, he was, I think, both in the Thatcher and Major cabinet. And his argument was, oh, you know, this is nonsense. Labour will just become more expensive if we don't have immigration, and more money will go to labour and less will go to capital, and the price of labour will rise and there'll be a shakeout, and you can't. And I do understand where he's coming from economically, but that would work in a purely market situation. If you said, all right, we're not going to have immigrants, we're not going to have immigrants in the care. Care homes will just have to put up their prices to pay the wages to attract the people. And what that ends up meaning is you effectively will have people who can't go into a care home, say, or can't have a carer come to their home. And then we will say, well, aren't we a compassionate society? Well, the answer will be under that system, no. If you are disabled or elderly and you're at home and you can't afford it, too bad. Well, we're not going to say that. You know, you can argue about how good our care and provision are, but the market economy in this country only goes so far. And I'm not arguing against compassion. I'm simply saying that as long as we have people with those requirements, there'll be a demand for labour. And simply thinking the market will fix it in a system where we override the market for compassionate reasons is not going to cut it.
Okay, so essentially the reliance on immigration to fix your demographic issues is a short-term solution that creates perhaps other problems and perhaps different type of problems further down the line. Because I think the one thing that I don't think sort of is talked enough about is there is an assumption that UK and the West is forever going to be this beacon of freedom and opportunity that people want to migrate to. And UK is already not the country that I came here to like 18 years ago. And I think that is going to reverse. I actually think that we are going to see the migration in the other direction for people that do have the choice into different countries that perhaps don't have the same amount of issues when it comes to the integration of the multiple cultures. And I don't think the UK has done a particularly good job of integrating cultures, essentially. I think especially in the recent years.
Well, I agree with you. I'm currently having a lot of renovation done on my house, and I am amazed that there are still so many poles. But I don't think in 5 or 10 years' time there will be. As I've said already, partly simply look at the number of 20 to 30-year-olds in Poland based on falling Polish fertility over the last 30 years. And secondly, look at the wage differential. I mean, England's very nice in many ways. Poland's very nice. If you're in Poland and you want to leave, you're going to leave. You need some motivation to do that. And whether you know, there are soft things like what's the culture like. There are harder things like what's the wage level like and how many people are there. But I think part of the reason we're not taking this fertility issue seriously is that we've had two very fortunate things in terms of immigration. First of all, Ireland has for almost centuries, you could say, been poorer and more fertile than Britain. And Britain, without almost thinking about it, was a huge pull. Loads and loads of Irish people came there. And I don't have many white British friends who don't have some Irish ancestry. So Ireland was a womb, effectively, for the British Isles, and Britain hugely benefited from an influx of Irish labour. Very often it was at the bottom end of the pecking order of the labour market. But, of course, Irish people integrated. In some ways, it took longer than you'd expect. I mean, I remember when the IRA bombs were going off. But there was no major social problem. I think most people, Irish people, were pretty well integrated in those days. Whether they continued to be Catholic, whether they continued to identify as Irish, the world carried on. So we've massively benefited from Ireland having a high fertility. Well, Ireland doesn't have a high fertility rate anymore, and the Irish have higher wages than the people in the UK. That doesn't mean we're not still getting people from Ireland. There's a two-way traffic, but the idea of mass immigration from Ireland is over. And I think Poland, in fact, the whole of Eastern Europe, it was another one-off boom that you actually had very well-educated people, people who could fit in culturally quite easily, who, because they'd been under communism for decades, were starting in a very bad place. And to come to somewhere like the UK was a big opportunity. You could come, you could work, you could save, and either stay and integrate or go home with some money. But I think that's over as well. And where there'll always be people, I think, always for the foreseeable future, who would rather be in London than .. or Birmingham than .. But the .. is increasingly going to become the high fertility countries that are left and the poor countries that are left, which inherently have a poor education system, not very skilled people. And that will drag the economy down. And as you say, there are all sorts of issues about integration complex issues about how you integrate people. I mean, I've said many times on podcasts, my parents are immigrants. You're an immigrant. We fit in. I feel 100% British. And if you don't, and you stay here, your kids probably will be nice if they speak Polish, they don't speak, they have a mixed identity. And so that's a different issue. But ultimately, it's going to be harder and harder if we think we can just bring in endless numbers of people, reasonably skilled, we're going to be disappointed. And of course, there is also a backlash, a populist backlash, which we see in many countries in Europe. The Front National in France is doing very well, may well be the next presidency. Meloni in Italy, the AfD in Germany, and Sweden in the Netherlands. Which is to say, whether you like these parties or not, they exist. They exist in a democratic system. And what they're telling the authorities that be is that the indigenous populations do not want endless flows of immigrants from all sorts of countries who eventually will put the indigenous element in a minority. Now, you can tut-tut and say they're not very liberal, it's not very nice. You can approve of it, you can disapprove of it. I'm merely observing the fact that endless immigration, which low fertility and economic growth requires, are not politically acceptable in a democratic system.
I think there is a, you referred to it with regards to Israel, and I think it was in the demographic trilemma, but it was some, and I'm paraphrasing, if you, you know, recruit a non-Jewish population into Jewish state, that state will become non-Jewish at some point. And I think this is the backlash that European countries are right now struggling with, is people do want to maintain and preserve their culture and their country. And there is a problem there that I can't see any party actively addressing it right now. Perhaps the only parties that are addressing it are still a little bit small. But I think just stating that fact that if you've got a group in the nation that is not of that nation, that is going to dilute the nation. It shouldn't be offensive or somehow outrageous to say that, but for some reason the discourse, especially in the mainstream media, has become very sensitive around saying anything that would suggest that any part of migration has got negative consequences. And I think at this point it's very difficult to actually pretend that we don't, because we do have big problems that at some point someone is going to have to talk about them.
Well, I think you can have different notions of the nation, and a myth of shared common ancestry is one thing. I do think people can assimilate into the nation and become part of it, as I think I and my offspring have done to some extent, and maybe you and yours. But that's always the idea, is an inflow against a background, a backdrop of a more or less stable and continuous population with its origins in the country. And, you know, the work I've done suggests that most years since 1997, we've had more immigrants into the United Kingdom or into the British Isles, because Ireland was part of the UK at one point for a long time, from, I think, 1801 until Irish independence. But if you look at the British Isles as a whole, we have more immigration every year than we had probably between the arrival of the Anglo-Saxons and the Second World War. And what I think is a bit disturbing is if you go to East Asia, it's obvious to them, to Japan and Korea particularly, that they wish to remain majority ethnically Japanese and Korean. That's not even debatable. And they don't debate it. They won't debate it because that's what they want. If you raise those issues in Britain, you can't even discuss them. So it seems like these issues of ethnicity, nationalism, what it is to belong, what it is to integrate, do we want people to, what are they integrating into? These questions are very, very difficult to discuss in the UK. Obviously, on the continent, that's somewhat different. In Poland, for example, where you haven't had mass immigration, that has been a debate. Do you or don't you want it? And that has been a major issue in terms of the very long-lived right-wing government you had until fairly recently. In Germany, because of its history, the AfD is still seen as something on the outside, but I think that's only a matter of time. Madame Le Pen gets a third. I think she got something like 34, maybe more, percent of the vote in the last presidential election. So these things are discussable in other cultures. They don't seem to be particularly discussable in the UK. But the point I keep making to get back to the trilemma is you may want to be a bit more ethnically homogenous, or you may want immigration to be limited, but don't delude yourself. There will be a price to pay for that if you are not prepared to have at least a couple of kids, 2 to 3 children per couple.
Okay, so is there a price to pay, or would there be a price to pay for the UK for raising their birth rates to replacement level or over, to, like I think you said, sort of 2 to 3 kids per couple?
Well, there are, you could think of the price to pay in two terms. First of all, how do we get there? And to get there, you probably need government policies that will cost money. Although I'm dubious that government policies that will cost money will do all that much. I think most of all, it's a change of heart, a change of values, change of priority. But if we had a load of kids, what actually, if you think about it economically, you need women or men. For example, I've got a grandson at the moment. My son-in-law's on paternity leave because my daughter-in-law did 9 months and he's doing 3 months of paternity. And so it can be shared, but you need somebody out of the workforce. Or you need more nurseries, you need people working in the nurseries, then you need more schools. So there's quite an upfront investment to make. But a child born today will require that investment. And then for sort of 19 years or 22 years or whatever, then he or she will go into the workplace and work for and pay taxes for perhaps 45 years. So in terms of a net present value, it's a very clear return. The problem is that the payback doesn't start immediately. And governments are implicitly working on a very short cycle. And it's very hard to say to a politician, with all the concerns and troubles and electoral cycles, do something now that is going to prevent an ever worsening problem in 20 years' time. It's going to require resources now. It's going to take people out of the workforce now. It's going to require some taxpayers' money now. We know it will pay back, and pay back generously and handsomely. But it's so much easier to say, well, let's not do that. Let's not build the schools. Let's not employ the teachers and the nursery nurses, et cetera, et cetera. Let's just bring in some immigrants who can start work tomorrow. But they get old, and as we've said, they won't come forever. As we've said, there are cultural challenges, which frankly we'd be much better able to talk about if we could, or better to deal with if we could talk about them, and if some of the taboos about them were to be lifted. But in any case, it's still relying on someone somewhere having children, because we're too busy, important, wealthy, educated, grand, whatever it is, to do that ourselves, which I think is a very arrogant attitude.
Is it? I'm just trying to think what is actually stopping the government from actually doing something, because they do stupid things, clearly, but they are not. They're not stupid. It's not like they don't know that this is coming, but I almost feel like the job is perhaps a little bit too big. They would almost need to overhaul most of the things that we do currently. I think it was Louise Perry wrote a research paper for ARC as well about making the childcare in the UK more friendly to parents, because right now the childcare in the UK is built around the presumption that the parents want to put their kids into the daycare as soon as possible. And I think the polling suggests that that is not the case for majority of the parents.
Well, that's because you have to pay fees, you're employing a nursery nurse, you then go out to work and pay your taxes. That is a much more attractive model for the Treasury than saying, well, actually, what about a woman staying at home, or maybe the man staying at home, or sharing it, or It doesn't grow GDP, and not only do governments want to grow GDP, but if you go out to work and you pay someone to look after your child, there's more tax coming, and the government desperately needs tax. So I think part of it is a, whether it's explicit and thought through or not, is a economic and fiscal model that eats its own seed corn effectively, because none of this will work without children.
Are we hooked to this model? Like, is there genuinely a way out?
There's a huge taboo about talking about it, so that's what I'm trying to address. And I'm working now, I'm going to work with a policy think tank and hopefully address the government on some of these issues. But we've never had a government. So Monsieur Macron, President Macron in France, has said this is an issue. We've never had a prime minister who said this is an issue. So before we can, and actually we have all these various policies, but what are they about? They're not necessarily about raising the fertility rate. They're about, for example, let's help people with childcare so they can go out to work and pay taxes. So I think we've never had explicitly pronatal policies. So I think people are very nervous about them culturally in this country. And you've seen the reaction I got to that article in the Sunday Times a year and a half or so ago. I think we've got to break that taboo, and I'm very happy to play my part in breaking that taboo, because I'm not a politician and I don't have anything to lose. I can talk frankly, and if I get cancelled, I get cancelled. So what? I'm not running for election in later this year. So I think we've got to break the taboo and be a bit bolder about talking about it. The other thing is, and again, I think I've made this point already, policy is important, but culture is even more important. And I think we've got to change the way that we're thinking about these things. So in my forthcoming book, No One Left, which I hope will be out sometime in the summer, possibly the autumn, I got a penultimate chapter entitled What Government Can Do For Us. And I look at the policies, do they work, what's been tried in Australia and Hungary, blah, 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 blah. Then I finish, the last chapter is What Can We Do For Ourselves? And I think ultimately one has to appeal to people rather than government. Government can nudge things, government policies, government can nudge the culture. But ultimately, if in an ever wealthier society, we've got ourselves in a position that we say we can't afford children, then there's something deeply wrong about the whole outlook, the whole ideology, the whole set of values, which is underpinning our society. And I think we need to start rethinking them urgently.
You know what? I mean, I am quite pessimistic about the next 5 to 10 years. I'm not going to lie. But the more I think about it and talk to people like you, like sometimes I do see a little bit of the light. Because like, for example, for me, I see woke ideology as it's only there because people just really don't have any meaning in their lives. And these are mostly young people. And I do think that pro-natalist culture would change that, and it would really infuse the meaning into the lives of people. But I do actually agree that like the culture is so important, because at some point when you are a teenager, you stop listening to your parents and you really start looking out into the culture to figure out your values, and you stay in that influence of culture until you're, I would argue, probably in your 30s, unless something drastically happened and you started really the journey of self-discovery a little bit earlier, unless something dramatically happened that would make you really grow up earlier than 30s. And I think that if we did manage to tilt our culture a little bit more towards different values, that would sort of pay back, and then perhaps, you know, did some policies from the government would help as well. Speaking of the policies, there is a little bit of...
Can I just interrupt you there for a moment?
Yeah.
Come back to policies. I think it raises a really interesting question, which I've discussed at length with my PhD supervisor, Eric Kaufman. He helped me, he advised me as I did my PhD. He wrote a very good book while I was doing it called Shall the Religious Inherit the Earth? And Eric, who is not himself a religious person or a practicing adherent of any religion, as far as I know, did ask me this question. I mean, always off the cuff, but it's such a profoundly important question. Can we do this? Can we ever get back to remotely anything like a replace the level fertility rate without becoming a much more religious society. And we know that in every society, pretty much in the Abrahamic tradition, Islamic, Christian, and Jewish, the more religious they are, you are, the more children you have. So I think that I don't have the answer to that question, although I try to wrestle with it in my book, a forthcoming book. But I think this is a very important question, because I don't particularly want to live in a theocracy. I don't even want to live in a society where everybody is very religious. I hope we have a plurality of attitudes and religions. I think religiously we work very well as a society today. But I think there's a very profound question about whether, without a complete change of values, we can get back up towards a replacement level fertility rate. And if we can't, what are those values? And can it happen without some kind of religious revival? I don't know the answer. I think is a really important question.
So let's dive just really quickly into the policies in Hungary. The Hungary has got strong pronatal policies, but I seem to hear the difference of opinion. Some people say that it hasn't really fixed their falling birth rates. Some people say that it stopped them from falling, or perhaps that they even recovered slightly, but that there are other very promising changes, such as increased marriage rates and way, way lower rates of abortion. And that was almost as a secondary effect. The government apparently were not actually specifically targeting abortions or marriage. They were really just focusing on the birth rates. Do we actually have the data or some sort of consensus whether the policies of the Hungary did work or they didn't work?
Well, I think you've summed it up very well, actually, and you're obviously well informed on the subject. So Lyman Stone did some work showing that actually the increase in the fertility rate in Hungary was largely not third children or fourth children, whereas in fact a lot of the earlier benefits were targeted at third and fourth children. That's one piece of data. Another is that although the Hungarian fertility rate has risen, it hasn't really necessarily risen in a very different way to that of Romania or the Czech and Slovak republics. In all those cases, what's happened with the rise from, say, 1.2 to, say, 1.4, 1.5 is something called the tempo effect, very largely, which is when women are delaying having their children. Over that period, in those years, the fertility rate is depressed. When that starts to end, when it starts to stabilize, because people have gone through having kids in their mid-20s on average to say their early to mid-30s, once that stabilizes, there's a kicker. And actually, the period of depression was a bit artificial. If you look at the cohorts, completed fertility, it's always a bit backward-looking, you'd find that there wasn't really a dip and a rise. It was just what was going on in those years. And TFR falling and rising was a delay in childbearing people. We know in lots and lots of developed countries, there's been a big drop in early pregnancy and a big rise in late pregnancy, but they don't compensate each other. So overall fertility has come down at the end of a fertile period. But the effect on the TFR is... So the fact that Hungary has gone down and then up, with all these prenatal, very expensive prenatal policies, but no more so than the surrounding countries, doesn't give what, plus the Lyman Stone point on the benefits of third children, doesn't give you that much optimism about the policies. On the other hand, I think you're absolutely right. It seems to have had more impact at the second order. Something's happening in Hungary around marriages, around births within wedlock. I don't know the abortion figures, but I can believe that goes with falling abortion. And I'm not sure that you can get a rebound of the fertility rate without these changes of values, perhaps a shift to more traditional values. We'll have to see. It's always very imperfect. You never know exactly which policy has caused a rise in fertility or prevented a fall in fertility, or maybe fertility raised for some other reason. So, in all respects, I'm just a little bit suspicious about the actual effects of the policy. I think where you have a government very positively signaling that it's very important to us as a nation to reproduce ourselves, it can only have a positive effect on the culture and therefore ultimately on the fertility rate.
I'm wondering whether these policies have actually been around for long enough to start influencing the culture, because the culture doesn't take months to change. That will take years. So I suppose it is, this is not a next day delivery kind of change that we are looking at. This is going to take years and years and perhaps decades to reverse and to fix. So just very briefly, I want to focus just quickly on Israel and perhaps the reasons for high fertility rates for Israel. Like you said, they are complex and perhaps duplicating high fertility rates of Israel are not going to be easy for other countries. But what is behind their very healthy fertility rates and very healthy economy?
In my first book, which was actually a book version of my PhD thesis, which is called Demographic Engineering, Population Strategies and Ethnic Conflict, I argued that what we have in Israel and the Palestinian territories is a conflict fertility rate, that actually the sense of backs to the wall, a sense of competition for numbers against the other has inflated Israeli and Arab fertility rates. If you look at the Palestinians, all the correlates which should suggest lower fertility than their neighbors is actually higher. So they are, for all the propaganda, and until the attack on Israel on the 7th of September, both in Gaza, the West Bank, and Israel itself, they have very good education, very high levels of nutrition, high levels of urbanization, high levels of income compared to the Fellaheen of Egypt. So, and yet the fertility is higher. So I think it's come down. So that it's just in the case of the Palestinians, it's delayed falling fertility because they're in a conflict of the womb, if you like. In the Israeli Jewish case, there was low fertility among those of European origin, as you probably know. Hundreds of thousands of Jews were forced out of Arab countries, went to Israel, and they had a high fertility, and their fertility rate in the modern conditions of Israel rapidly fell. So the Jewish fertility rate fell. And then sometime in the early mid-90s, it started to go up. And I think that is partly to do with a sense of backs to the wall, I think, and being surrounded by enemies who wish to destroy you. I also think there is something in the culture, and it's very intangible. But if you look at non-observant Jews in America, they have a very low fertility rate. It's not just a specifically Jewish thing. I think Israel, I've been there a lot, and I think it is a country where people are obsessively prenatal. They love children. They'll smile and give advice to pregnant women. And the government policies in some ways are very prenatal, so there's a lot of IVF. But on the other hand, the rights to go back to the workforce, your maternity, the rights aren't all that great. Child benefit isn't huge. So there's just something about the culture there. And it maybe all stems ultimately. It's very hard to map these things. Sometimes I think, someone was suggesting to me not long ago, something that has occurred to me myself, that atheists have this attack on religion, the God of the gaps, that God explains all the things science can't explain, and then science gradually explains more and more, and God kind of is pushed out of the picture. It's not what I believe, but there is a sort of Richard Dawkins view of the God of the gaps. And someone was saying to me, well, isn't culture the sort of social science explanation of the gaps? What you can't explain in other ways, you call culture. And culture is inherently complex, difficult to understand. But I think you can get going a prenatal culture. And you can often see it in its shadow. So if you talk to Israeli women who don't want children, they'll say, and there's writing about this, how they feel pressured and the whole cultural environment pushes them towards having kids. Now, I don't know exactly what lessons we can learn from Israel. It's not straightforward because we are not going to be that kind of back-to-the-wall society which had to struggle for its existence from day one. Even though there are lots of secular people in Israel, there is a religious element, ultra and somewhat religious. The more religious you are, the larger your family size. And I don't think that's going to be a big issue in Britain. I don't think we have a pronatal religion. I can't see the Archbishop of Canterbury inspiring people to have larger families. They'd probably be horrified at even the suggestion. So I think it's worth looking at, and it's worth, if we look at it and understand it, and other cases like Georgia, where the metropolitan, the head of the church, said he'd baptized 3 children or more, and that's led to some, appears to have led to some kind of baby boom, or at least a more respectable fertility rate in Georgia. We've got to look at all these examples and try and think through how they apply to us in the UK and in other Western countries. But we're not even going to start this conversation until the authorities, the government, actually says, yes, we have a problem.
Okay. There was so many things that I've learned from your book, Tomorrow's People, The Future of Humanity in 10 Numbers. I love the really clever way that you've actually framed the 10 numbers. The one thing that really surprised me, because I thought that I understood the Soviet Union and the whole way that it disintegrated well enough, I never realized that their dropping fertility rates was contributing to the fall of Soviet Union. That was so fascinating to me.
Well, can I recommend you also read my book, The Human Tide, which has a chapter on the Soviet Union?
We'll definitely
looks at it
do.
In a more historical context.
It was just fascinating. I find that your lens through which you see the issues is just really refreshing, because we haven't really had so much of that when we are talking about the current issues. So for the people that want to find out more about you and your work, where can they go and find you?
Put my name into Google or any other search engine, Paul Morland, M-O-R-L-A-N-D. You'll find my website. And on my website, I have all my podcasts, my articles, and links to my books. I'm also on X.
Thank you so much. And I can't wait to read your new book. I think we need more solutions and ideas to the problem.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for tuning in to Wisdom Rebellion. Come and join the conversation on our YouTube channel and socials. The links are in the show notes. And don't forget to follow, rate, and subscribe to the show so we can all build a wiser world together.